comic books, movies, TV, and more. Nerds are everywhere. It's time to assemble! It's Nerds United, a Jittery Monkey podcast. Here's your host, Greg Mahochko.
Hello and welcome to a brand new episode of Nerds United on the Jittery Monkey Podcast Network, jitterymonkey.com, home of such fantastic podcasts as Nerds United, My 1-2-3 Cents the Podcast with Kevin Huntsberger, over 250 episodes, and they drop every Monday. He hasn't missed a single week since he's the new flagship at jitterymonkey.com. There's Positive Cynicism with Chad Smart, and then there's my other podcast, the Five Heart Podcast. And I'm looking forward to joining all of my fellow Cornhusker fans in Champaign, Illinois this weekend for a big Saturday night game in the Big Ten. I am thrilled. It is episode 149. And if you've been a longtime listener to Nerds United, you know that it started out as an interview show where I was fortunate to sit out with creators, individuals who, you know, either write or draw or make comic books. And it evolved, and you know, about a year ago or a little over a year, I brought in the co-host of the year, Mike Luther. And don't worry, he'll be back at the end of the week for episode 150. But for episode 149, I am so thrilled to have one of my new favorite writers, and that's only based on five issues of a comic book that, at least perhaps in part one, wrapped up, and you can check it out at your local comic book shop from Aftershock Comics, Descendant. I am thrilled to have Stephanie Phillips with me. Stephanie, thank you so much for taking time out. You're busy. I'm busy. It's a Monday night, and I hope this is, for you, the best way to close out your Monday.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
So let's get to it from the beginning. Tell us a little bit about yourself. You know, where did you grow up? Where was home for you?
Sure. So I'm from Tampa, Florida. I've been in Buffalo now a little over a year. I took a job at the University at Buffalo teaching writing to engineers. So my master's degree is in English, and I'm working on a PhD in rhetoric and composition and technical communication. So I teach engineers how to write and communicate with people outside of engineering.
And anybody who has ever watched a single episode of something like The Big Bang Theory knows that it can be a little, different trying to communicate with, and I look at it from, you know, I have a community college associate's degree and a certificate from a broadcasting school. Take that with a grain of salt. I'm not in radio anymore, but I feel like I can jump into a conversation and, you know, carry my weight. But I also say this with complete respect of individuals who are that smart. You know, I got a friend of mine whose daughter goes to Purdue for, you know, their engineering program. And I think his other daughter goes to Ole Miss. I mean, it's, kids that I graduated with went to the University of Missouri in Rolla for, you know, engineering. There's something about engineering, something about smart people. We'll just put it that way. That, you know, sometimes there can be a little bit of, I don't know, social awkwardness in communication. And maybe it's a little bit exaggerated in a show like Big Bang Theory, but I think a little bit of that element is there. Is that something that you have experienced in the classroom?
Well, I think the biggest issue is that, like, I mean, with any field, once you become so specialized in it, you're taught to speak kind of your own language. So an engineer that's been through 4 or 5 years worth of classes and maybe add a master's degree, so a couple more years, they're really embedded in, like, this language about how to talk about engineering and what they do. And that doesn't always translate to the public or somebody that maybe didn't take 4+ years of engineering courses and doesn't have the same kind of vocabulary and background. So we're kind of working with them about how to both talk to their peers effectively and then also talk to somebody that doesn't have the same kind of experience and background that they have. So it's always interesting working with engineers, and I kind of like it. They're just a bunch of nerds, which is super fun. So it makes the days go by a little bit faster. But yeah, I enjoy it. I came from an English department at the University of South Florida to work in an engineering department. So it's been a bit of a shift, but I'm enjoying the change.
Well, let's talk about shift, because you go from South Florida to Buffalo. And I don't know if you had ever been to Buffalo before you moved to Buffalo. I've never been. However, I hear that it weather-wise is nothing like South Florida.
No, they're pretty different. There's a lot more snow in one place, for starters. It was an adjustment. I'm still adjusting, but I kind of like having the seasons. I'm like a kid. Every time I see snow or orange leaves, I kind of freak out a bit. So, and my students always have weird questions about Florida. Like, they find the stuff about like Florida Man or stupid things that happen in Florida, and they're like, "Is this real?" And it's like, yeah, it's kind of like Florida is that like really ridiculous sibling that like you can make fun of, but then when other people start making fun of it, you're like, wait a minute, like, I get to do that, you don't. I lived there my whole life, so
no,
it's interesting. It's been an interesting change.
Well, let's talk a little bit about growing up in the Tampa area or South Florida. Growing up, were you always a comic book fan?
Yeah, largely. I was never a collector, and I'm still not really a collector per se. I always like getting things that friends work on, and I collect art, but I used to, just as a kid, I was obsessed with Batman, so I would honestly just buy any Batman cover I thought was cool. There was a comic shop next to where my mom would get groceries, and if I was good, I got to go get a Batman cover. So
nice.
I was really picking things out based on the art, and I just liked the design of Batman, particularly in the 90s. And then with the animated series, I became even more of a Batman fan. So I think growing up, like, I never read anything really consecutively until I was a teenager. And then I started realizing, like, oh, these books I was just randomly buying are actually parts of larger stories. And so then it kind of clicked. And then I think college is around the time I discovered more indie books and started kind of reading more on the indie side.
So let's take a quick look at Batman, since, you know, Batman was the first character that at least caught your eye, maybe caught your imagination. Do you have – let's talk big screen first in the, you know, on-screen Batman portrayals. Do you have a favorite?
Live action? Because my favorite would still have to – like, I just love the cartoon animated series Batman. But I don't know. Live action. I guess I really like the first one with Christian Bale.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, I liked the first one, and then from there, I think I liked the other two less. But that was probably one of the first movies I remember seeing on screen in theater and being like, whoa, like the production quality of my favorite superhero being awesome. That was pretty cool to see.
And something of a, you know, it's weird talking to a billionaire who flies around in a suit with a cape and you know, kicks crime in the butt. But, you know, a more realistic take than, you know, the ultra neon of the 90s with, you know, the Joel Schumacher movies. But I really like the Batman Begins, you know, Christian Bale version. There's something about watching his trek across, you know, the world to find the man he, you know, eventually becomes. It obviously, you mentioned Batman the animated series, and you know, I'm a big Kevin Smith fan, and I know he says, and a lot of people say, when you're reading a Batman book, Kevin Conroy is the voice you hear every time you hear or reading Batman. That's the voice that you hear, that iconic voice. And now, you know, we found out earlier this summer, I think at San Diego Comic-Con, that Conroy for the first time ever will actually be on screen as Bruce Wayne / Batman in the upcoming CW Arrowverse crossover. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's awesome. And Mark Hamill has always been the voice of Joker for me. And
yeah,
portrayal of Joker just based on the voice alone, I think he's phenomenal.
You mentioned, you know, finding the Batman on the rack. You know, if you were in the grocery store, you get to go get the Batman cover. As you know, maybe went back in through some of the perhaps a deeper history in Batman art, you know, artists like Neil Adams, things like that. Do you have a favorite Batman artist or someone who, when you think of Batman on the page,
yeah,
you think of this person?
I mean, Jim Lee is the first name that came to mind, because I think around the time I started actually buying books consecutively, like buying full arcs of stories, I was getting a lot of Jim Lee stuff. And so that really stuck out. Though I think the first full set of Batman comics I owned, I think, was Long Halloween. So that's pretty iconic in my mind as well.
I don't think anybody will, be asking for your nerd card if you said Jim Lee's my favorite Batman artist, because that's one of the iconic, he's one of the iconic comic artists, period. But, especially when you think of Batman, he's right up there with, for whatever reason, I find myself an Alex Ross guy. I just love his style, his more visual paintings. But Jim Lee, Neil Adams, those are, you can't go wrong. I mean, I don't think anybody's ever done Batman poorly. I mean, even like Frank Miller, everybody puts their own unique twist on it. But I do find it curious that what caught your eye or what got you into comics early on was cover art, but you didn't follow that up in the realm of becoming an artist. You went the writer path. So what has creative writing, has that always been, part of your core?
Yeah, I think so. My dad still has this somewhere, I think, in his office, but I wrote my first comic when I was like 3 years old about a werewolf, and I made like a series of books about this werewolf. My art is very poor, and I couldn't really write well, so in the dialogue balloons, my dad would help me write the dialogue in for these really tragically bad stories, but I was making comics as a kid because I liked the form, and I loved comics, even though I wasn't reading anything as like a heavy reader. I mean, I was a toddler, so I just liked action and superheroes and monsters. Adam's Family and Nightmare Before Christmas were a huge part of my childhood, so I liked monsters, and I think I was writing a lot of stories and comics about monsters at the time. That seemed to be a big part of my childhood.
Have you ever just, hearing that you that somewhere your dad has these, comics that you kind of created when you were three, have you ever just taken a glance back at them and said, I've aged since then. I've honed my craft a lot since then, but there's something about, maybe revisiting that and bringing it back into the you that is you now.
Yeah, it's kind of funny that they've been so, even at times when they were in like the periphery of my life, it's kind of funny that I ended up on the path to where it's now really my career. And I don't think I expected it, especially not when I was three drawing werewolf comics. But yeah, it's really cool to kind of see how everything kind of led to this one area, and to think back to the days when I was a kid writing comics and picking up Batman stories because I just really liked Batman. So it's kind of cool.
And nobody will fault you for liking Batman. Do you think there's always that question that pops up in every kind of comic book conversation, and everybody, who's the greatest superhero out there? Who's the greatest hero? And everybody either says, like Wolverine or Batman or something like that. But do you think that Batman, and I'm not trying to start controversy, I promise, but do you think that maybe he's a little overrated by the larger internet comic book community?
I don't know. Like, I'm sure somewhere on these blog sites with people talking about it, but I think this question of like the best superhero is just really like a nostalgia question. And the person that spoke to you, like, I think I just liked creepy things as a kid. I liked Bats and Adam's Family, and like actually sitting in front of me is a literal like dead bat, like petrified bat. Those are the kinds of things that I have in my office and on my desk, because I'm just, I don't know, I think it's weird and bizarre and fascinating, and I love that kind of stuff. So I think I was definitely just attracted to the tortured superhero in all black who likes bats. Like, I like bats, I could do this. So I mean, for me, loving Batman is just like a huge part of my childhood. I mean, every year my mom gave me a Batman birthday cake. To this day, she will still give me Batman birthday cakes, which is one of the most endearing qualities of my mother.
That's fantastic. So it sounds like your parents, from the Batman cakes to your dad holding on to the comic that you made when you were three, great parents who have supported you from the beginning.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, my dad is probably the only person that's read every script I've written, published, unpublished, everything. He's read every pitch, every script, every log line. He is, I think he's the most invested in what I'm doing. I know he'll read. I sent him like a series of pitches the other day, and him and my mom and sister, he told me later, like, read them aloud and discussed them, and then they sent me notes. And so, yeah, it's kind of a cool thing that I get to share with my family.
And do you think that because they know you so well and have known you for so long that I feel like, you know, if I bounce an idea off a buddy, he's like, oh, you know, that's a good idea. But they can give you an honest and even perhaps sometimes critical evaluation of, well, you know, we like where the story's going, but this character is rubbish. You know, that type of thing. I mean, is all the feedback just super positive and, no, you're doing great. Keep going down that path.
I mean, it's a little of both. Mm-hmm. I definitely welcome the, like, that's part of why I have them read it, is I want to make sure everything is, you know, as good as it can be. But, yeah, I mean, I think what did my dad said something the other day after reading some of the pitches, like, I don't know how you turned out so creepy or with such a dark sense of humor or something. And I was like, well, my first book I learned to read on was an Addams Family book. So, I mean, I feel like I was not the one to blame in this.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your writing career, because how long have you been writing? I guess that's a great way to start. How long have you been writing comics then, as far as, you know, aside from, you know, starting at the age of 3?
Yeah, no, So I first went into academic writing. So in my master's and PhD program, I published a lot professionally, and then just really didn't like writing academically. So I started writing for like hockey websites and doing kind of more like reporting work, and then kind of found my way into comics. So I've been doing comics now, I would say, like, since professional publications, about 2 years. I was working on some stuff before that, but since like the first publication dropped, it's been about 2 years. And yeah, so it's kind of just all happened at once and all of a sudden became my job, which is great.
I feel like we completely almost glossed over an important aspect. Hockey.
Yeah. I grew up playing hockey, oddly, in Florida, like roller hockey, and then made the switch to ice. And the first book I published was a graphic novel about girls playing ice hockey. The artist Jamie Jones and I created it with the National Women's Hockey League. So that came out. We were working on it in 2017, but I think it came out early 2018, maybe? Something like that.
Kicking Ice from Ominous Press. By the way, everybody, I would like to say that I just know this stuff off the top of my head. I'm actually it's part of my research. I'm in the conversation. I'm on Stephanie's website, and you can be too, stephaniecomics.com. So, yeah, Kicking Ice through the National Women's Hockey League. First of all, I couldn't tell you anything about the National Women's Hockey League, but I know that the U.S. women's hockey team, the Olympic team, is just insane. Badass and always fun to watch.
Yeah, they're great, and we kind of got really lucky in that we were already working on the book, and then right as the book was dropping, they won gold at the Olympics, and we were like, well, that's perfect timing. So the book was actually on ESPN and another like media outlet with some of the women from the U.S. Olympic team, like holding the book and talking about it. And so that was really cool, like being able to see professional athletes holding the product. And I kind of joke because I wanted to be an athlete growing up. And I was like, well, I never thought this is how I would make it onto ESPN, right. But here we are. So
so was having that hockey background then – did the artist on that project, did she also come from a hockey background or?
No, actually. So Jamie was pretty new to hockey. And the best part is, so Jamie and I have known each other. He's also from Tampa and he's still there. And it's kind of funny because every once in a while I would get messages like pictures of him watching hockey, and he's now very engrossed in the sport, and we've made quite the hockey fan out of him. And the best part is he knows way more about the National Women's Hockey League than the NHL. I was like, you're one of the few people, Jamie.
I know this will be good information for you and anybody else who appreciates hockey. Chad Smart, who I mentioned at the top of the show, the host of Positive Cynicism, just this past season completed his trip to all the NHL arenas.
Oh, that's awesome.
Including a return to Boston during the Stanley Cup Final.
Oh, that's very cool.
Which, as a guy who is a Blues fan and lives 15 minutes from downtown St. Louis, I said, you ass.
that's so cool.
But he has a rotation of co-hosts, and one of them, quick shout out to Mike DeKalb and their series called Wonder Why, where they break down one-hit wonders and look at the band or artist and say, why didn't they have more than one hit? But Mike's website is thehockeytransplant.com. So they're big hockey fans over there as well. Sidebar, enough about them. So from kicking ice, and I'm, tell me if I get the timeline wrong, you went to, or not went to, but you started working on Devil Within from Black Mask Studios?
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about Devil Within, because that's, as I said at the outset, I have read all of Descendant, but so far that's all that I've read. So,
so Devil Within is... It's based on a true story of possession that took place in the Philippines. So it's about an American transplant who is living in the Philippines, her and her partner buy a house, they're getting ready to get married, and then her partner starts experiencing what she thinks is a possession. So it's really asking the question, like, what would you do if you thought the person you were sleeping beside was possessed? So it kind of, it's a horror story and a love story wrapped up together. And of course that does not end well.
I snore. So I'm pretty sure that on occasion, my wife thinks that the person she's laying next to in bed is possessed. So, where would somebody be able to find from Black Mask, The Devil Within? Because it's not one that I've, you know, seen. Would it be something that'd be available through Diamond that, you know, a local comic book shop should get, or?
Yeah, it should be. Through Diamonds, I mean, I believe you could actually order it directly from the Black Mask website. I could be wrong, but last time I checked, it was on the website. You could probably also ask your local comic shop if they don't have it in stock to order through Diamond as well.
And to confirm, that is a fact. And through StephanieComics.com, when you go click on Devil Within, you can purchase from Black Mask. You can purchase from Comixology. As I'm a big proponent of my local comic book shop, and I think everybody should be proponents of theirs and supporters of theirs. Of course, my comic book shop, Twilight Comics, Swansea, Illinois. But there are ways, if you're not in the Swansea, Illinois area, where you can acquire Devil Within. So let's get to, I'm going to call it the main event.
All right.
This, you know, kind of much like yourself, you know, when I got back into comics in 2007, it was, you know, I did things backwards. I got a tattoo of the Green Lantern symbol on my arm, Sturgis, South Dakota, during bike week. It's a long story. It's a short story. I had friends who had tattoos of, you know, Superman logo, Batman logo, Flash. I'm like, well, I want to be in the Justice League too. You know, let's slap the Green Lantern logo on there. But I didn't know that much about the Green Lantern. Since then, of course, I've educated myself. But I was definitely a cape and cowl guy up until, you know, just a few years ago, where I started branching out, looking at, you know, more independent books, more, you know, from Image Comics and Dark Horse and Top Cow, which we're going to mention them here in a little bit. There was something about the cover, as you mentioned, you know, and I think when you're in a comic book shop and you're looking at the wall of books, the cover, it's going to be like being in a bar trying to hook up. Bad example, but, you know, trying to, you know, find a date, find a mate, whatever. There's going to be something visual that's going to track you to person, or in this case, the book. So Descendant number one, as I'm just browsing around, it caught my eye. And I wish I had it here in front of me. I've got 2, 3, 4, and 5, but I loaned number one out to the co-host of the year, Mike Luther. But it caught my eye, and I said, well, I'm going to check this out. I'm very curious about this. And I, from the moment where they mentioned the Lindbergh baby, I was hooked. So tell me a little bit about the story, the development of Descendant, maybe how the story came to your mind, and then how you framed it out over the 5 issues that have been published so far.
The story actually started with the Lindbergh information. So I knew I wanted to do something with that. Just it kind of fascinated me. I've read a lot of books about Lindbergh and kind of the history and the kidnapping, and started to learn a little bit more about like kind of behind the American hero stuff that, you know, they don't really teach you up front in a lot of history classes. And some of the conspiracy theories around the kidnapping. So even though somebody was tried for the kidnapping and murder of Charles Lindbergh Jr., there were these kind of budding conspiracy theories about maybe Lindbergh actually hired somebody because his child was not perfect, didn't fit the mold, had a disability. There was like a whole host of reasons that people thought that this was the case, and some like weird evidence for it that, you know, take it with a grain of salt. It's on the internet. So right. I don't trust much on the internet, but it's out there at least as theories that some people buy into. And I thought it was fascinating. I'm not really a conspiracy theorist myself, but I knew I wanted to do something with the Lindbergh kidnapping. And so it really started there. And then almost like a story about David started as almost a separate thing, like a conspiracy theorist investigating things on his own light. The ex-wife Amanda was a part of it. And then I was like, well, why? I have these two pieces. They should kind of be connected together. And I met with Aftershock at San Diego, I think, not this past it. Like a year ago, and they were immediately interested and invested in the story, and kind of wanted to see where it was going. Gave them some proposals for it, and I think I signed to work on them with it like a week later. So Aftershock is really the only place that really ever saw that idea. We developed it kind of in part together, and it grew from there.
The February 2019 article on Deadline.com, you're quoted as saying, imagine National Treasure meets the X-Files and you'll get close to Descendant. Having read, and we mentioned this off air in the prep aspect of it, but everybody knows that unless we're, you know, going to talk about Avengers Endgame or Spider-Man Far From Home, or, you know, and hopefully giving people enough time to watch it, I tend to avoid spoilers. I'm going to do my best here. Spoiler or not, I can't recommend this book enough. Again, check it out at you know, from your local comic book shop, or you know, if you got to wait, you know, a few more months till it's in a trade paperback collected edition, that's fine too. But I from the Lindbergh baby to, you know, bringing up the Salem witch trials. I mean, this is deep rooted in American iconic mm-hmm. history, and you know, what I think, you know, while it's on the continent, but technically pre-American, you know, history as well, when you go back to the 17th century, just how did you work the two in? And I'll give a mini spoiler to people here. There is a cult-like element involved, but, you know, so but how did you weave those kind of two different stories and have them tie together?
I knew I wanted a starting place for the cult, and there are actually there are kind of other little I guess Easter eggs, we'll call them, kind of throughout the book as well, in terms of unsolved mysteries or missing persons throughout the book. That like there's a point where David is reading names out of the book of other people that have gone missing and saying, we've heard of some of these, but they're starting to kind of connect them to the cult. All of those names are actually unsolved cases, missing persons cases in the U.S. And so I tried to do the math of like timeline of when people would match up to when this cult was active, starting with the witch trials. And I kind of wanted the cult to have, kind of a both a religious and a political component to them. And there's really you're hard pressed to find, I think, better villains than Puritans. Their sermons, just whenever Mathers is talking, a lot of what he's saying is built out of actual sermons and things he's said. Same with a lot of the political figures that appear in the book. They are they're saying a lot of those lines and sentiment come from current politicians' speeches, campaign promises, and things like that. So I kind of wanted those two things to connect. Like, there's been this history of deep-rooted supremacy, whether it's about race or religion, and these people have never gone away, and they're more evil than we thought because there's now this supernatural component to it. Again, it's a little, I'm not going to give a spoiler, but kind of the end is supposed to reveal that this entire time they've actually been the ones that have been played kind of in the system when they thought that they were doing something for a higher purpose. So, I wanted them to look like idiots in the end, because that's exactly what they are. And I thought there was no better place to start than with the Salem witch trials to give kind of the supernatural element, but also as like our starting point to look at American history and look at our past. Even the way we revere certain figures that have kind of that flip side where, like, I mean, you watch The Spirit of St. Louis and the way that Lindbergh is portrayed as this great American hero. And one of the characters in the book talks about seeing that movie as a boy and just how inspirational and heroic it is and patriotic. And then you find out that Lindbergh has had a host of children outside of marriage across the world. He spent a lot of time in Germany, believed in eugenics, was involved with Nazis. And this is maybe not the great American hero that you're led to believe. So a lot of the book is kind of about, here's what we're given on the surface in American history classes. But behind that is maybe an element of truth that is sometimes difficult to swallow. And then I added a supernatural layer, because who doesn't like monsters and demons?
for me, it's, as I mentioned, I'm such a cape and cowl guy, but some of the stuff that I enjoy, you know, like from even the big two publishers, tend to have, you know, a heaven and hell element. Etrigan the Demon is one of my favorite and more underrated characters on the DC side. But I've noticed something about my buying and reading patterns is on the indie side. There's that, you know, supernatural, you know, that primeval good versus, you know, bad, good versus evil element that I just enjoy reading. So this was really right up my alley, because it combined history, which I love, that supernatural, which I love, and just a little, just enough humor. However, I've got to say, Stephanie, the end, in a non-spoiler way, like, if it's over, because at the end of issue 5, this is a spoiler just because it could be a spoiler, because I'm not giving anything away, but there's that delightful, I got it, it says, the end, ? So, cliffhanger possible. It didn't. Yes. It didn't need a cliffhanger. If it would have wrapped up with the, I think they call it in Wayne's World 1, the super happy ending, or, you know, whatever. If it would have ended that way, great. If it goes on, if the story continues, even better. But the way those last couple of pages played out, I was on the edge of my seat. And then as you get to that last, you know, last two frames, I wanted to rip my hair out. I was like, no! Because as you said, you know, the good guys have been kind of played the fool. And and there's – it's unresolved. And yeah. Like, and we'll talk more about what's in the works for Stephanie Phillips. But I do definitely hope the Descendant continues on, because – because of that last page, because of that last frame, there's more story to be told.
I think those two, and the second arc would really heavily just feature David and Sarah. First, their relationship is just my favorite part of the book and favorite thing to write. And also, like, just letting them explore kind of what we're saying as the cliffhanger from one. And, you know, having Amanda built in there as well, because I like her relationship with David as well. So I know where this is going. I really hope we get to tell more of it. Evgeny and I both really like working with these characters. And so I know we're both kind of fingers crossed that we get to tell the rest of it.
Yes, we definitely need to mention your artist, Evgeny Bornyakov. I'm hoping I got that right.
Yep.
And also colorist Lauren. I'm going to have you help me with. What's Lauren's last name?
Lauren Affey.
I was going to say that. I didn't know if the E was silent. but the three of you just did tremendous work on this all around from the story to the art. I think that the kind of the palette that was chosen gave it – set the right tone. It blew my mind. And five issues of a comic book, you know, was not enough. So I hope Descendant continues. Tell me a little bit about Aftershock, because as I mentioned, Descendant was the first one, the first book under that publisher that I'd ever come across. So what can you tell me about the history of Aftershock?
Aftershock has, I think, just continuously done some really amazing comics. Well before I started working with them, they were just on my radar as this is the place I want to work with. I liked everything they were doing. I'm a huge Garth Ennis fan, and they were publishing some great stuff with Garth, like working pretty heavily with him. And I mean, everything that they've put out has just been fun and interesting and different. There are no two series that I think are exactly alike or even that similar. They are taking some kind of wild ideas and bringing them to life and letting creators do some kind of interesting stuff that I don't know that other publishers would experiment with as much. I mean, they're doing things all over the place with history. Garth has done a lot of World War II books with them. They're doing other formats, like graphic novel formats now, anthologies. So they're a lot of fun to read. I recently have been finishing Hot Lunch Special by Elliot Rahal, which I highly recommend. It's awesome. And Evgeny Bornyakov, my artist on Descendant, has a new series called You Are Obsolete with them, which I think the first issue just came out this week.
Some other names that people might recognize who have or are working on some stuff with Aftershock: Colin Bunn, Jim Starlin, Phil Hester. I'm actually looking at the back of issue number two, so I'm just because they're Shock Volume Two. Which, by the way, an all new collection featuring original stories by, and then the, you know, Garth Ennis, as you mentioned, Jill Thompson. The list goes on and on. That is available at your local comic shop as of June 26th. So we're a couple months behind on that. But Aftershock, I you know, just based on Descendant, I'm going to continue to look for that publisher in my local comic shop, and everybody listening, I hope you do as well. Let's talk a little bit about what is in the works, because you know, it seems like it, and this is not a knock on Aftershock or Black Mask or Ominous, but the more work you get, the bigger the publisher that you get to work with, which brings us to one of your several next projects in Dark Horse Comics, and The Butcher of Paris. So tell me a little bit about Butcher of Paris, because just based on the brief synopsis that I'm reading, and you too can read at stephaniecomics.com. It's a period piece taking place in 1944 Paris. You know, it's World War II Europe. Right there, I'm kind of in the bag. So tell me a little bit about Butcher of Paris and what we can expect out of this story.
Yeah, so this one, I've been working on this story for years. I knew it was something I wanted to work with. I found it kind of by accident. I was reading a book about World War II, and there was a mention of a trial in Paris after the invasion of Normandy. And I was kind of curious about what that was, so I started kind of looking at some of the footnotes, followed the trail. I found this serial killer that was active for 4 years in Paris, and the death toll is unknown, but it sits somewhere between 60 and 200 victims. So in the middle of Nazi-occupied Paris, when there are clearly political tensions, the city is war-torn, people are being deported to concentration camps. I want to say something around the ballpark of over 7,000 people were taken to concentration camps, with only 2,000 returning home. The city is in tatters. Like, this is one of the most horrendous times in history, and in the midst of it is a serial killer that saw this opportunity. So, I mean, I can't imagine, and it's really hard to wrap my mind around somebody that sees this setting and says, I have this idea to make money. Marcel, the serial killer in the book and in real life, his strategy was to offer an escape route to Jews fleeing the city and would, you know, covertly at night have them show up to an undisclosed location and murder them and steal their belongings and burn their bodies, put their bodies, body parts in lime pits to dissolve all evidence, which is part of the reason why they don't know exactly how many victims were killed by this guy. So the story itself, which you know, our team has done a lot to kind of keep this very historically accurate, but given, you know, that this killer was active for over 4 years, there's a lot of history there, and our miniseries is 5 issues, so it's heavily based on it, and, you know, we show a lot of the history as well, but it's really about the city and about kind of looking at the war from another perspective, which is this kind of small event that I think, given the large scale of the war, went perhaps a little unnoticed in the city. So it's kind of another perspective of the war through kind of a filtered look at the French police that were very heavily policed by the Gestapo, trying to basically race the Nazis to figure out this guy Marcel, is he a resistance fighter? Was he killing Nazis? Or is he a Nazi actually killing Jews? Or this other wild out there option, he's just a monster killing people at random and taking their belongings. He's just seeing opportunity. So there's a lot of history. Everyone that appears in the book was a historical figure, actually existed at the time. The detective who is our main character, George Victor Massu, was like a French Sherlock Holmes. There was kind of some lore about Detective Massu, about him being this, like, he is the real life French Sherlock, and he was pretty heavily liked at the time. So we're kind of at the end of his career. He has a son who's kind of his partner in real life. His son Bernard did actually go with him to crime scenes. He was studying law and was kind of like his sounding board. So it's almost like this Sherlock and Watson dynamic between the old detective who has worked serial killer crimes in the city of Paris, but now has this new threat of dealing with the Nazi occupation. The Nazis heavily policed what the police could do in the city of Paris. So there's a lot of resistance there. I really think it's a story about tension. It's heartbreaking, really just at times difficult to write and difficult to really get into the story because it is so dark. And I mean, it's so dark and so disturbing. I couldn't have made this up, really.
Is it one of those... does it affect you more as a writer because it is a true story? I mean, if you're coming up with something out of your mind that you're like, well, you know, I'm just thinking this up, but this isn't actually real. But now you have to go back to, you know, 75 years, give or take, you know, a couple here or there, to real life events. And you're like, there was somebody out there who was this evil. Does that weigh a little heavier on you?
It does. The victims are not people made up in my head. And then also, I mean, beyond that, an interesting thing about this one is there are just layers of serial killers. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, during the trial of Marcel, I was reading a lot of transcripts from the trial. And granted, it's transcribed from French, but at some point they were like, people loved it. This became a media circus at the end of the war, especially with the liberation of Paris. People just loved this guy. He was witty and sarcastic. I mean, a little like if you've watched Ted Bundy on trial, how he like engaged the audience. He had female admirers. It was like a very early version of that. And this people had never seen anything like this, and they had just lived through years of occupation. So they were interested in a show. And at some point, one of the attorneys just like was very fed up with this. And he was like, does the sanctity of life mean anything to you? And it kind of hit hard that the audience really doesn't have a reaction to this, because it's like, well, they just watched how many people die from war and in concentration camps. I mean, Marcel's, let's say, top number. He killed 200 people. How many did the Nazis kill? How many people died in the war? That number is barely a blip. And I think that's really part of what the story is about, is even if it was one person out of 30,000, war and fascism and these kinds of horrific war crimes are kind of stealing people of their empathy. And it's really a look at how the city is reacting to that. So yes, it's very difficult to read at times. And I also took it as an opportunity to learn a lot more about my own family during the time period. They fought primarily for the Dutch army. And then I had a couple relatives that fought and were killed on the US side as well. And I'm Jewish. So it also kind of brought me, I think, to learning a lot more about my Jewish heritage, which I started growing up with. And then, you know, around the time being a teenager, like, I don't want to do this. This isn't cool. I don't want to, you know, I don't really care about this. So it kind of gave me, I think, an opportunity to revisit some of my own heritage as well.
Well, like you mentioned, you know, if Marcel's victim count, you know, body count was 200, you look at D-Day alone. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're in the thousands. I definitely understand where the general mindset would be, you know, there's been death all around us for years. Not to be as callous as what's 200 more, but, you know, it more in the lines of, well, that's small potatoes to, you know, this, you know, entire city being wiped out or something like that. However, there is a personal, like a personalized type of, manner in which he went about it, which I this is the first time that I've heard of it. So I'm looking forward to reading the book and hearing all the gruesome details. But because it, you know, because it was so personal, because it was, you know, like, hey, I'm trying to help you, or at least that's what I'm telling you. And then I'm going to help you escape this life by ending yours type of thing. I mean, there's a, I don't know that difficult to compare the two. But it almost seems more, it seems, all right, this is going to sound, I don't know if there's a nice way to put this, but it seems like that's more evil than soldier given orders to go, you know, in the trench or go to the front and do what soldiers do. Like I said, this is a difficult topic. Let's move on. Let's talk about the creative team that you have working with you on Butcher of Paris.
Yeah, so interior art is by Dean Kotz and Jason Wordy. So Dean is doing line art and Jason is the colorist. And I mean, honestly, and Troy Petrie is my letterer. He worked with me on Descendant, Devil Within, Kicking Ice. He's working on my Top Cow book. I really don't know that there's a book I haven't worked on with Troy. It is absolutely the perfect team. I could not think of a better person to be doing interiors on this book. Everything that Dean turns in is just perfection. Jason's colors are a really interesting palette, and I think it's going to be a really unique looking book on shelves. And then Dave Johnson is doing all the series covers. So the first cover that they revealed, I guess, last week, Dave is, you know, obviously a fantastic cover artist, and we got really lucky having him on the series.
And just the cover for number one, which, by the way, I'm excited to tell people that Butcher of Paris number one, it's a 5-issue miniseries, goes on sale December 4th, 2019, available for pre-order at your local comic shops. Pre-order, pre-order, pre-order. I'm going to tell my good folks at Twilight Comics, Swansea, Illinois, make sure that they secure the Butcher of Paris for me. But that is something striking about that first cover, because it's, you know, you have the dark background, you have the very I don't know, against it you have the white of the butcher's cleaver, and in blood red is the Eiffel Tower with like a river of blood coming from the bottom of the blade. You can't miss it if you're you know, in your local comic book shop. It's pretty tremendous. Mr. Johnson, I'm not on a first name basis with him. I'm just going to call him Mr. Johnson. He did a terrific job with that, and I'm excited to see what the covers for 2, 3, 4, and 5 look like as well.
They're fantastic.
So How much of the artwork have you seen? I mean, for me and for the listeners, how far out in advance? I mean, like, with issue number one set to hit stores in December, how much of the story do you have done, or do you have all of it done, and are, you know, just waiting for the art and everything?
The series is completely written. Three full issues are drawn. Dean and Jason are currently working on the art for issue four. We have series covers pretty much completed. So we did a lot of back-end work. I've been working with the team on this book for a year, if not more. So actually, I think more than a year. So we've had quite a bit of time to kind of get everything together. And then it was kind of just picking the right time that, you know, Dark Horse wanted to, or thought it would do really well in shops. So
I think it's going to be a big hit. As I mentioned to everybody else, December 4th, but it's not too early to get those pre-orders in at your local comic book shops. The Butcher of Paris. You did mention Top Cow, and I teased it earlier in their conversation as well. So what are you working for them? Because you were named something. It escapes me, and I closed that particular window. But from Top Cow, you were a top. Say that again.
So every Top Cow does a talent hunt. So I was selected as a talent hunt winner. I can't remember if it was 2017 or 2018, actually. So I think I may have applied in 2017 and was selected as a winner in 2018, something like that. My timeline might be very off.
In 2018.
Okay. So 2018. I really like working with Top Cow and my editor over there. So we've been kind of working on something for a while now. It's called A Man Among Ye, and it is about pirates. So just, you know, trying to visit as many historical time periods as I possibly can. It's specifically about female pirates, both the mythology elements to some of the real life female pirates of the era, but it's kind of about the very end of like the golden age of piracy. So it's about a group of pirates that are just not ready to let go. England kind of gave this almost like an advance, saying if you give up this life of piracy, we will give you a pardon and some money to basically start a new life, like a good life, and not be pirates anymore, because it was becoming such a problem for, you know, the Navy and merchant vessels and things like that. So piracy was really dying out. It was actually getting harder and harder to become a pirate and like get away with it. But piracy really added an element to some people's life that I think was really hard to give up, in terms of like people that just didn't want to be a part of the state, people that didn't feel like they fit in, the outcasts, women, people of color that just were not allowed to do a lot of things in normal society, found piracy to be a good home for themselves. So this is about, you know, female pirates that don't want to give this up. They don't want to accept this pardon. They don't want to lose the life that they've built. And it's based pretty heavily on real life again. But there's so much mythology around these pirates that, you know, it's hard to not have the really awesome pirate battles and, you know, cannons and cool ships and things like that.
I think it's a unique and perhaps not perhaps, I'm going to go out on for the record and say it is an underrepresented facet of pirate history. You know, that, and I'm not, you know, talking Captain Jack Sparrow or anything like that. And I'm no pirate historian, but you don't hear too much about the female pirates. And the fact that they were essentially trying to be bought out of the business, you know, like the crown was trying to be like, hey, you know, we can't really afford to go around you anymore, and we're not doing a good job trying to go through you. We just like to buy you out. And they're like, no, it's not going to work for us. We're having too much fun. Or, to quote the song from the Disneyland ride, A Pirate's Life for Me type of thing. So that's definitely an interesting take. And it's something else that, you know, I'm excited to see. This is going to sound, you know, going back to Capes and Cowls, when Darkseid zapped Bruce Wayne / Batman out of, you know, at least present day existence, and he had to battle his way through. And I think Grant Morrison did that run where he was working his way back to present day, but, you know, he was started out as a caveman. He was a Puritan. I think he was a pirate at one point. I mean, that's just, that was gold for me because it combined history, it combined, you know, some heroics. I'm excited because the next question from me to you then is, what's the next era of history that you want to tackle?
I think I'm tackling them. I have still quite a few unannounced projects. 2020, I believe I have 5 creator-owned projects that will hit stands. A Man Among You will be one of them. Butcher of Paris will run into 2020, obviously, and there are 3 more that will be announced over time and are exploring some of my favorite time periods, and I don't think I can talk about them, which is really unfortunate because I have a favorite genre and I am getting to write it, and it's historical and it's awesome, and it is, I think, going to be a lot of fun.
So I cheated and I just now Googled A Man Among Ye, and the top hit was from SmithsonianMag.com. It says, if there's a man among ye, the tale of pirate queens and Bonnie and Mary Read. Are those a couple of characters that might make appearances in your story?
So, A Man Among Ye comes from Anne Bonny's last words. So she was a complete badass, actually. Part of the mythology of the two women is that when they killed men, they wanted to make sure the men knew they were killed by women, so they would flash their breasts at them. Which I find quite quaint. So when Anne Bonny, when their ship was finally overtaken, Anne Bonny was ready to go down fighting. The rest of the crew were not. So she basically called them losers by yelling down to them, if there be a man among you, you'd stand up here and fight beside me. And nobody did. She died fighting for kind of a lost cause, which is interesting. But I really like that those are some of her last words, just basically saying she's more of a man than any of them. And I like her sentiment about that. So I thought the book was aptly named after her last words, A Man Among Ye.
She had more testicular fortitude than all of her crew combined, it seemed.
Absolutely.
This has been a real blast, Stephanie, and I want to thank you so much. I'm excited for Butcher in Paris, for A Man Among Ye. I'm keeping my fingers crossed for more Descendant. You're definitely, I mean, it's been a blast to talk to you. I'm so glad that I picked up Descendant one random Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday at Twilight Comics, Swansea, Illinois, because it brought us here, brought us through episode 149. And what I enjoy about these conversations is, had I not ever talked with you, it might have just ended at Descendant. But because of our conversation, I'm definitely going to be keeping an eye out for your works, and I'm going to go and I'm going to tell Brian and Tim at Twilight Comics, Swansea, Illinois. If you haven't figured out, right, that's kind of my gimmick. I always put them over big time. But I'm going to say, all right, I need The Butcher of Paris, and then when it's time, I'm going to need A Man Among Ye as well. So thank you so much for spending some time with me. I know you're in the Eastern time zone, and you know, you're busy and now I'm busy, so it's getting late. But I just want to express my complete gratitude and appreciation for you spending a little bit of time talking with me tonight.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate you letting me talk about some books, and thanks so much for reading.
And you're a Parks and Rec fan.
Oh my gosh, yes.
So we might have to hold on, buddy. I'm almost done. Okay. All right. Can you say hi?
Hi.
Okay. Can you say bye?
Bye.
Okay. Go back to the couch. A cat lover, a Parks and Rec fan. Most people, they have a preference, Parks and Rec or The Office.
Parks and Rec.
Okay, well, I mean, nobody's perfect. No, definitely looking forward to more products. And everybody, if you haven't heard by now, StephanieComics.com, or follow Stephanie on Twitter at Steph. That is STPH_smash, because Steph smashes comics.
Awesome. Thanks so much for having me.
That's Stephanie Phillips. Hang out until the end of the week, everybody, because Mike Luther, the co-host of the year, will be back for episode 150. It's going to be special. I don't know why, but we're going to figure something out to do. That's been Stephanie Phillips. My name is Greg Mahochko. And Stephanie, you remember video stores back in the day where you have to, you know, rent a cassette and bring back a cassette?
Absolutely.
You remember what they always had, like, stickers on the cassette before you brought them back? What they always said, reminding you to do?
Like, rewind the tape first?
Yes, that's how we like to end the show. So if I say be kind, will you say that one special R word that gets us out the door?
Sure.
All right. She is Stephanie Phillips. I'm Greg Mahochko. This is Nerds United, and we remind you this week and every week to be kind.
And rewind.
This is a production of the Jittery Monkey Podcast Network. For more jittery shenanigans, go to jitterymonkey.com.